Chapter 4. The Future of India. Will India rise to become a great power? And if so, on what timeline? What constraints does India's system of democratic governance impose on its long-term prospects? What constraints does India's culture impose on its long-term prospects? What are India's current economic strengths? What are India's long-term economic challenges and likely performance? What are India's economic prospects relative to China's in the next decade? How significant for the rest of Asia is India's democratic model, especially in contrast to China's authoritarian model? Can India serve in Asia as a strategic counterweight to China? What is the forecast for U.S.-India relations? As a longtime observer of India's economy, politics, and regional role, Lee Kuan Yew is uniquely positioned to answer the preceding questions. Will India rise to become a great power, and if so, on what timeline?
On my earlier visits in 1959 and 1962, when Nehru was in charge, I thought India showed promise of becoming a thriving society and a great power. By the late 1970s, I thought it would become a big military power, but not an economically thriving one because of its stifling bureaucracy.
What constraints does India's system of democratic governance impose on its long-term prospects?
India has wasted decades in state planning and controls that have bogged it down in bureaucracy and corruption. A decentralized system would have allowed more centers like Bangalore and Bombay to grow and prosper. The caste system has been the enemy of meritocracy. India is a nation of unfulfilled greatness. Its potential has lain fallow, underused. And there are limitations in the Indian constitutional system and the Indian political system that prevent it from going at high speed. Whatever the political leadership may want to do, it must go through a very complex system at the center, and then even a more complex system in the various states. Indians will go at a tempo which is decided by their constitution, by their ethnic mix, by their voting patterns, and the resulting coalition governments, which makes for very difficult decision-making. It is part of the constitutional system which has been accepted by the people and is established now. There will be a constant tinkering around with state boundaries, linguistic affinities, caste quotas. All those adjustments detract from a dynamic meritocracy and prevent India from maximizing its potential. India's political leaders are determined to reform, but the Indian bureaucracy has been slower and resistant to change. Regional jostling and corruption do not help. Furthermore, populist democracy makes Indian policies less consistent with regular changes in ruling parties. India has poor infrastructure, high administrative and regulatory barriers to business, and large fiscal deficits, especially at the state level, that are a drag on investment and job creation. If all Indian ministers and top bureaucrats like Narayama Murthy, co-founder and former chief executive officer of Infosys, hard-working, tough taskmasters, hard negotiators, but always forward-looking, India would be one of the fastest-growing countries in the world, and one generation will become a first-world country. However, Murthy probably realizes that no single person can change India's system of governance to become as efficient as Infosys.
What constraints does India's culture impose on its long-term prospects?
India is not a real country. Instead, it is 32 separate nations that happen to be arrayed along the British rail line. The British came, conquered, established the Raj, incorporated under their rule an amalgam of 175 princely states, and ruled them with 1,000 Englishmen and several tens of thousands of Indians brought up to behave like English. I am against a society which has no sense of nurturing its best to rise to the top. I am against a feudal society where your birth decides where you stay in the pecking order. The example of that, par excellence, is India's caste system. India is an established civilization. Nehru and Gandhi had a chance to do for India what I did for Singapore because of their enormous prestige, but they could not break the caste system. They could not break the habits. Look at the construction industries in India and China, and you will know the difference between one that gets things done and another that does not get things done, but talks about things. It is partly because India is such a diverse country. It is not one nation, but 32 different nations speaking 330 different dialects. In China, it is 90% Han Chinese, all speaking the same language, with different accents, but reading the same script. If you stand up in Delhi and speak in English, out of 1.2 billion people, maybe 200 million will understand you. If you speak in Hindi, maybe 250 million will understand you. If you speak in Tamil, 80 million people will understand you. So there is an enormous difference between the two countries. We are comparing oranges and apples. Let me not be misunderstood. The upper class in India is equal to any in the world. The Brahmins, who are the children of the priests, are as bright and as smart as you can find anywhere in the world. But they face the same hurdles. And also because, in their caste system, if you are a Brahmin and you marry a non-Brahmin, you go down in caste, so your genetic pool is frozen in each caste. The average Indian civil servant still sees himself primarily as a regulator and not as a facilitator. The average Indian bureaucrat has not yet accepted that it is not a sin to make profits and become rich. The average Indian bureaucrat has little trust in India's business community. They view Indian business people as money-grabbing opportunists who do not have the welfare of the country at heart, and all the more so if they are foreign.
What are India's current economic strengths?
India's private sector is superior to China's. Indian companies follow international rules of corporate governance and offer a higher return on equity as against Chinese companies. And India has transparent and functioning capital markets. India has a stronger banking system and capital markets than China. India has stronger institutions, in particular, a well-developed legal system which should provide a better environment for the creation and protection of intellectual property. India, with an average age of 26 compared to China's 33, and with much faster population growth, will enjoy a bigger demographic dividend, but it will have to educate its people better, or else the opportunity will turn into a burden.
What are India's long-term economic challenges and likely performance?
Unless India moves away from its mindset, it will be a case of lost opportunities. It has to build superhighways, introduce superfast trains, build bigger and better airports. It will also have to accept that to be a developed nation, it has to move its people from the villages to urban areas, as China is doing. After Indira Gandhi's son died, I said to her, "Take this chance, open up India, change the policy. Look at Indians overseas, see how well they are doing in England, in Singapore, all over the world. You are confining and conscribing them by your policies, by your bureaucracy." She told me, "I cannot do it. This is this. That is the way India is." I did not see anybody else. She had the gumption to declare a state of emergency, and by the time you have the guts to do that, you should have the guts to change the system and let Indian enterprise break out. So that was when I became resigned that India was going to go the slow path. And at that time, I saw China rising, breaking away from communism. So I knew that the race would not be an equal one. I gave up. India is a thicket of rules and regulations and bureaucracy that you have to find your way through. India probably has 3 to 5 years to fix its infrastructure. If it does not, it risks losing out in the global economic sweepstakes. India must emulate the effective way in which China has built up its extensive communications and transportation infrastructure, power plants and water resources, and implements policies that led to huge FDIs, foreign direct investments, in manufacturing, high job creation, and high growth. India's spectacular growth has been in IT, information technology, services, which do not generate high job creation. The moment India has the infrastructure in place, investments will come in and they will catch up very fast. What India needs is a more liberalized system which allows more international competition to enter. Then it will be able to play to the level of international companies. India lacks fast connectivity between cities. Once it gets its logistics right, roads, ports, railways, and cuts down red tape, it will get jobs not only in IT, but in manufacturing and all. Jobs will grow and the country will be transformed. To create jobs, the main thrust of reforms must be in manufacturing. That requires a change in labor laws to allow employers to retrench workers when business demand is down, streamlining the judicial processes, reducing the fiscal deficit, loosening up the bureaucracy, and most of all, improving infrastructure. India cannot grow into a major economy on services alone. Since the Industrial Revolution, no country has become a major economy without becoming an industrial power. Corruption bedevils both, but bureaucratic red tape has lowered India's efficiency and effectiveness more than China's. India needs to, first of all, cut down on red tapeism. Second, provide greater incentives for the private sector. Third, address the challenge of infrastructure shortages. And finally, liberalize foreign direct investment norms in the country. Even now, when India liberalizes, it sells state-owned enterprises, but says that it cannot dismiss workers. How the hell is it going to make them profitable? How can it expand and make them productive and begin to employ workers on a different basis? India's narrower band of educated people will be a weakness in the longer term. And although top-quality Indian manpower is in high demand, large numbers of engineers and graduates lack the skills required in a changing economy and remain unemployed. Only over half of each Indian cohort completes primary school, a big loss. India's leaders, starting with Nehru and his generation, were mesmerized by the supposedly rapid growth and industrialization of the Soviet Union. And, of course, this is what British economists of the time were recommending. Big capital accumulation, big projects, iron, steel, making agricultural implements. Then you develop. They believed in it. When India started changing in 1991-92 with Manmohan Singh, who was himself a planner, they had already lost 40 years of growth. They had the problem now of dismantling all these monopolies, and the unions are now part and parcel of these big state-owned companies, who do not want them to be privatized, because if you run them efficiently, the workforce will be reduced by two-thirds or one-half. India's history has left it skeptical of foreign investments and inward-looking in economics. Policies of self-reliance are no longer relevant in an interdependent world with fast-changing technology. A second relic of India's historical legacy is its preoccupation with fair distribution. To redistribute all the gains in the early stages of growth will slow down the capital accumulation necessary to generate further growth. Wealth springs from entrepreneurship, which means risk-taking. The only way to raise the living conditions of the poor is to increase the size of the pie. Equality of incomes gives no incentive to the resourceful and the industrious to outperform and be competitive. The lack of an economically educated electorate has made it easy for India's leaders to engage in economic populism, which has unsettled the course of liberalization. National interest is often subservient to special interests. Many needed reforms have been stalled due to opposition from special interest groups. Special interests thrive in an atmosphere of populism. In the last 20 years, there has been a proliferation of schemes for cheap food, free power, and subsidized loans. They impose a heavy cost on the whole economy. The distinction between welfare and populism has blurred. There are 3 Indian schools in Singapore. They were going to be more, but I said no. You either go to a Singapore school or you go back to India, because if they, Indians, stay on as permanent residents and do national service, they are not readily absorbed because they have been oriented toward Indian culture. The textbooks in these schools are all India-oriented. The knowledge is Indian, the sentiments, and everything. That is the problem. India had many first-rate universities at independence, except for a few top universities such as the Indian Institutes of Technology and Indian Institutes of Management that still rank with the best, it could not maintain the high standards of its many other universities. Political pressures made for quotas for admission based on caste or connections with members of parliament.
What are India's economic prospects relative to China's in the next decade?
Do not talk about India and China in the same breath. They are 2 different countries. But does that make India a non-player? No. It is a bigger player than the whole of ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, put together. The systems are not comparable. China's GDP, gross domestic product, is 3.5 times that of India. India is growing at about 2/3 the rate of China. But India is a big country and a counterweight in the Indian Ocean. India's economy can grow to about 60-70% that of China. It is not going to be bigger, on present projections, but 60-70% of China with a population which will be bigger than China's by 2050 is something considerable. And India has some very able people at the top. Why has China's peaceful rise, however, raised apprehensions? Is it because India is a democracy in which numerous political forces are constantly at work, making for an internal system of checks and balances? Most probably, yes, especially as India's governments have tended to be made up of large coalitions of 10 to 20 parties. India can project power across its borders farther and better than China can. Yet there is no fear that India has aggressive intentions. India does not pose such a challenge to international order as China, and will not until it gets its social infrastructure up to first world standards and further liberalizes its economy. Indeed, the U.S., the European Union, and Japan root for India because they want a better balanced world in which India approximates China's weight. What if India were well ahead of China? Would Americans and Europeans be rooting for China? I doubt it. They still have a phobia of the yellow peril, one reinforced by memories of the outrages of the Cultural Revolution and the massacres in Tiananmen Square, not to mention their strong feelings against Chinese government censorship. China is focused on the U.S. and just wants to keep the Indians at arm's length. I am not sure that India wants a piece of the consumer demand from China's growing middle class, because India is scared of the competition. The Chinese have offered the Indians a free trade agreement, but the Indians have not snapped at it because Chinese goods will go into India and compete. As long as there is free market bargaining, India will just have to learn to outbid China. China will not go to war with India. It is prepared to take risks. For example, it is in the Niger Delta, risking Chinese lives or Chinese money, but it has decided that it is worth it. It is in Angola and Sudan. It wants something out of Iran. It is making friends with the Central Asian republics. It wants a pipeline from Kazakhstan into China over thousands of kilometers, and it is prepared to build it. This is free market competition. I do not see it as being, if you agree to sell to India, I will beat you up, but rather as, whatever India offers you, I will offer you more. It is going to play by the rules of the game and is quite convinced that it can win that way.
How significant for the rest of Asia is India's democratic model, especially in contrast to China's authoritarian model?
It would be significant if it was achieving better results than China's model, but it is not. Political systems that yield inferior economic performance will ultimately be discarded for those that are more productive. Democracy should not be made an alibi for inertia. There are many examples of authoritarian governments whose economies have failed. There are many examples of democratic governments who have achieved superior economic performance. The real issue is whether any country's political system, irrespective of whether it is democratic or authoritarian, can forge a consensus on the policies needed for the economy to grow and create jobs for all, and can ensure that these basic policies are implemented consistently without large leakage. India's system of democracy and rule of law gives it a long-term advantage over China, although in the early phases, China has the advantage of faster implementation of its reforms. If China's political structures do not adjust to accommodate the changes in its society resulting from high rates of growth, India will have an advantage because of its more flexible political system in the longer term.
Can India serve in Asia as a strategic counterweight to China?
I have a selfish motive in wanting India to emerge as early as possible as a major economic power in world politics. If India does not emerge, Asia will be submerged, Lee's statement to J.R.D. Tata in 1974. Lee Kuan Yew emphasized the necessity of an Indian presence in the region, either through multilateral security arrangement or by the enunciation of an Asian Monroe Doctrine to dissuade possible poaching in Asia. He said India was the ideal candidate to undertake such a role because she had been conducting her foreign policy on a basis of equality and not on a basis of power relations. The role that he envisaged for India was that of a guardian, as he urged India to take an active interest in the security, political stability, and economic development of the smaller Southeast Asian nations. Sunanda K. Dattare's assessment of Lee's view of Southeast Asia following the withdrawal of Western powers in the late 1970s. Korea is too small. Vietnam is too small. Southeast Asia is too disparate. You need another big player to hold the balance. Who is the counterweight? Japan cannot be the counterweight. Together, Japan and America can be a counterweight economically, physically, and militarily. But who is the ex-counterweight within Asia? Because America may, in 100 or 200 years, become less able to dominate Asia. But the Indians are here for keeps. India has succeeded in modernizing its armed forces, especially its navy, and defending its security. Although the Chinese are building a port in Burma and another in Pakistan, India will dominate the Indian Ocean for a long time. India does not geographically fit in the Pacific, but the contest between the U.S. and China will be in the Pacific and the Indian Ocean. China has moved naval forces into the Indian Ocean to protect its oil supply from the Gulf and commodities from Africa. That is where the Indians are a force. If the Indians are on the American side, the Americans will have a great advantage. So the Chinese have to have a counter and have developed ports in Myanmar and in Pakistan. India does not exert much economic or geopolitical influence in Southeast Asia because the region's attention is focused on China, which is the source of power projection.
What is the forecast for U.S.-India relations?
There is no immediate U.S.-India strategic partnership to encircle China. Even when the relationship grows, India will remain an independent player. It will defend its interests with China and cooperate with China where their interests coincide.